can art do that propositional truth cannot? It just makes us feel things in a much more embodied way. So it's one thing to say that God is great, but it's another thing to be standing in front of a towering Gothic cathedral with like a sunset behind it and feel it rising above you just vertiginously so that you practically can't even see the top. And then it's covered with all this dazzlingly complex ornament that just almost feels impossible to comprehend. And so in that moment, the greatness of God, you can feel it so viscerally and so powerfully in a way that I think you could never feel if you just heard that propositional statement, God is great.
Katie Kresser is Seattle Pacific University's resident art historian. She's the author of books on John Lafarge and on how the death of Christ ushers in the birth of art as a window onto the divine. A former guest on this podcast, she's my guest also today to discuss a new book on Christianity and art titled Church Beautiful, Sacred Art and Spiritual Healing. I'm Matthew Wickman of BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute. So Katie, back on the podcast, time in person, good to have you here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure. I've enjoyed my time here so far. Thank you.
It's great you're here. In fact, you are the semester's Faith and Imagination lecturer, but your first time at BYU, you told me, right?
It is, except a really quick drive-by several years ago just to see the scenic beauty of the campus, but I've never been in any of the buildings before, so it's been a pleasure to get to know the campus better.
Well, welcome, and can come back sometime too.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking today about your recent book. It's on the cusp of publication, is that
right? It is. I believe it's slated for release on May 1st.
Okay.
There's already a pre-order page up on the Wipfenstock website. So
fantastic.
Yeah, it's going to be rolling out really soon.
Fantastic. And it's titled Church Beautiful and subtitled Sacred Art and Spiritual Healing. Just a quick nutshell argument, overview of the argument. What is the book about?
Yeah, thank you. The book is really a call for everyone, but I think Christians in particular, to rediscover how material culture can be used to enrich our faith lives and help us grow into more kind of fully fleshed, integrated people. I believe as a student of art history that our species, human beings, have been remarkably effective over the millennia at kind of leveraging material culture that is art, fashion, sculpture, visuals, space, movement through space, all kinds of things to discover what those things can communicate to us in a providential way. So, I mean, I believe God gave us all these things to communicate to us holistically about his plan for us, his love for us. But I think in our modern world, we've kind of lost touch of how a lot of that works. And through this book, by walking people through kind of specific ways that material culture has communicated in the past, I hope I can help modern people rediscover those modes of communication and then kind of activate parts within themselves that hadn't been fully activated to receive kind of the divine communications all around us.
Okay, great. I read the book. I love the book. Thank you for sending me an advanced copy of the book. I appreciate
it. Yeah, absolutely.
Let me ask you about the subtitle of the book, Sacred Art and Spiritual Healing. When someone says healing, it implies injury or illness.
It does, yeah.
Right? So I'm wondering, what is the sickness or the injury from which sacred art can help us recover, actually?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, I have become quite interested in recent years in the ways that I think a lot of us are very soul sick. Traumas we've experienced or certain deprivations we've experienced that make us unable to kind of move forward confidently in the world, understand who we are, live confidently into human relationships. I think these are like psychological level, soul level wounds that are actually very debilitating, and they can even sort of resonate outward into our physical bodies. And so I have become very interested in how we can heal those kinds of wounds, I guess. And I think art and material culture are one of the ways. But these are like traumas, deprivations, things that are natural to us as human beings. I mean, well, anyway, yeah, there are things we naturally need as human beings that we aren't getting in the modern world. Those cause trauma and deprivation. And my book wants to address how we can solve some of those issues.
Okay, great. Let me read here from the beginning of your introductory chapter in the book, which you touch on some of these things, and you kind of attach this to some interesting manifestations of this desire for healing in even pop culture. Here's what you write in that chapter. We live in a broken culture. Levels of distrust and anger are high. Among young people especially, clinical depression and anxiety are woefully common. Patterns of self-isolation, the deliberate checking out from community life, are on the rise, as evidenced by thousands of struggling churches and civic organizations. Though we may be comfortable on the outside, many of us are struggling on the inside. Yet amidst our suffering, we clamor for the liturgical, even sacred experiences hidden within secular culture. Mm-hmm. So among these hidden experiences, you mentioned like Disneyland, mm-hmm. right? You mentioned celebrity culture. Mm-hmm. We're recording here only a few days after the Oscars ran.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
So how are these popular phenomena indicative of deeper religious impulses?
Yeah, I mean, I have been struck for many years about the religious aura that surrounds things like the Oscars or other gala events. Prom for teenagers, there's just this, I don't know, magic around things like that, and people stand up a little bit straighter, and they spend so much money and look forward to it so fervently and feel transformed when they're in those spaces, and they consider them keystones of their experience. And yet things like the Oscars, you know, what the Oscars are actually celebrating is something relatively trivial in the whole scope of things, certainly like senior proms in high school, similar. So we have these energies that we want to point towards something great and transcendent, but we don't really point them in the right ways. Nevertheless, I think the fact that we're constantly deploying these energies shows that we have them inside of us and we want to point them somewhere. And part of what this book does is invite people to kind of point them in the right direction.
Okay. Is this the kind of book, is this the kind of concern you've had for a long time, or is it kind of just distilled on you more recently? And if you've had the concern for a long time, is this the kind of book you could have written 10 years ago? Or does it kind of require that you got into a certain place in your understanding, in your career, mm-hmm. to be able mm-hmm. to write a book like this one?
Yeah, good question. I think part of the reason why I entered art history in the first place is I had this, and this is going back 25, 30 years probably when I first started, you know, becoming obsessed with art history. I felt there was a lack in my environment growing up in rural southern Indiana. I felt like there was a lack in my church. I felt like my small Protestant church didn't bring all of the excellence and beauty and giftedness that human beings can bring to the divine, didn't bring it in that space. There was stuff we were leaving out. And I wanted to figure out how that could become reintegrated, how we could make the church kind of a space that fires on all cylinders, really the way it's supposed to be. Over time, I kind of recognized a lot of the cultural and historical barriers to that and why my church was the way it was and why a lot of other churches in my area were the way they were, and kind of started digging deeper back into history and understanding how some of these cultural patterns unfold. I think in terms of my new book, a turning point came when due to some curricular shifting at my school, I was invited to start teaching classes on world art instead of Western art. Mm. And through this, I began to learn a lot more about liturgical practices in other world religions, and also about liturgical practices in very, very deep ancient humanity. And just began to see how certain patterns have always been with us, patterns of devotion, patterns of using our environment in a certain way, of using beauty in a certain way, that frankly, as human beings, we tended to leverage pretty profitably for thousands of years. And it's really only recently that we've kind of forgotten about some of those things. And so my current book is taking just this big, huge, it's very big picture, big zoom outward, and then big deep dive backward as well into ancient history to try to figure out what is intrinsic to our human condition that we're missing out on. And that is probably something I only could have written in the last few years, in the sense that my teaching responsibilities forced me to expand my scope, and also kind of the trial and error of my career earlier kind of made me realize, you know, some things don't work, you know, maybe this will work. So yeah, I think it has been a process of trial and error too, in terms of convincing people and connecting people to try to integrate these beautiful material cultural things into their religious practice.
All right. So a few years ago, my mm-hmm. wife and I went to Rome, mm-hmm. Our first time there.
Yeah.
And we spent a lot of time going to different churches. And mm-hmm. not only the Vatican, but there are lots of just glorious
yes.
churches there.
Love
that,
Rome.
That mm-hmm. are works of art themselves.
Absolutely.
And are filled with works of art. And by comparison with those churches, everything is impoverished.
Yes,
okay,
that is right.
Artistically,
I agree.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, in churches, you know, yours, mine, others, there is lots of rich unfolding of propositional truth.
Yes. Uh-huh.
What does art do that just pure propositional truth unfolding.
Yeah.
I cannot.
Yeah, the good question. I want to say, too, I think part of the reason why I wrote this book is because of my many trips to Rome as well.
Yeah, okay.
And feeling the, I do this through a study abroad program at my school. I've been to Rome now 8 times with students, and just absorbing that environment and living in it for a month and absorbing its beauties has been hugely influential on me. But yeah, what can art do that propositional truth cannot? It just makes us feel things in a much more embodied way. So it's one thing to say that God is great, but it's another thing to be standing in front of a towering Gothic cathedral. There aren't really Gothic cathedrals in Rome, but to stand in front of a towering Gothic cathedral with like a sunset behind it and feel it rising above you just vertiginously so that you practically can't even see the top. And then it's covered with all this dazzlingly complex ornament that just almost feels impossible to comprehend. And so in that moment, the greatness of God, you can feel it so viscerally and so powerfully in a way that I think you could never feel if you just heard that propositional statement, God is great. And so, those things, they just bring it home to us. And I think God gifted us with the ability to create things like that so that we could have those experiences. But we tend to squander that aspect of ourselves, I think, especially now.
Yeah, you know, when you say that, you bring back a memory of mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a missionary for 2 years in France and Switzerland. And one of my last cities was Clermont-Ferrand,
mm-hmm.
In the middle of France. There was a large church made of volcanic rock,
mm-hmm.
and so the church, had kind of, the rock had kind of darkened over the years, so it stood out from the rest of the buildings very dramatically. And one of the things we would like to do was very tall, and
mm-hmm.
we'd walk to the very edge of that church, right to the wall, and look up, and you'd have this ornamentation on it, but you'd also then see the sky above it, and the clouds were moving.
Mm-hmm.
It was like earth and sky both moving in
yeah.
motion. It was
mm-hmm.
very dramatic
mm-hmm.
and very moving, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It was an example of kind of being moved by something physically
yeah. mm-hmm.
that would be hard to distill down simply to
mm-hmm.
a compelling statement.
Yes, right. Completely agree. Things like height, complexity, luminosity, deep darkness, vastness. These are all things that speak to us at a deep, deep level and communicate to us about the nature of God in a way that words just simply cannot capture, I think.
Yeah, good. You mentioned your book, The Case of Catherine of Siena, the
mm-hmm.
14th century Italian mystic,
mm-hmm,
right,
mm-hmm.
who wrote that we have to taste Christ,
mm-hmm.
not just believe in
mm-hmm.
Christ, right?
Yeah,
which is an example
mm-hmm.
what you're talking about.
I think so, yes. I feel like the mystics have always kind of just intrinsically understood this kind of better than a lot of the rest of us. And
yeah.
then they try to coax us to grasp for the same experiences, but we don't always follow. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to ask the professor, or a question
mm-hmm.
that a professor of English like me might ask, or someone who's interested in philosophy.
Uh-huh.
I years ago, I remember reading this famous introduction to aesthetics by Hegel, the 19th century German philosopher, who believed that poetry was the most exalted of all
mm-hmm.
art forms. And for Hegel, all things move towards some grand conclusion
yes.
in philosophy. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know that I'm devoted to that, but one
mm-hmm.
of his ideas is that poetry is the most advanced of all the art forms because it combines the sensuousness of music,
mm-hmm.
sound,
yes. uh-huh.
with kind of language, so kind
mm-hmm.
of like the concept,
mm-hmm.
and that combining sound and language, you kind of fuse art forms together. And if Hegel's not right, that poetry is the most advanced
mm-hmm.
of all the art forms, and if you think there's a special power in the visual arts, is there one form of art that you find the most powerful mm-hmm. or richest? Is it painting? Is it
mm-hmm.
sculpture?
Mm-hmm.
Is it architecture? Is it something else?
Mm. That's a really good question. And Matt, as you know, we talked very briefly about Hegel and the art museum today.
We did,
and
yes.
which, by the way, is such a lovely campus art museum. You guys are so blessed to have that museum. But, you know, what I think now upon reflection is I think Hegel was able to say what he said because, I think what he said is valid, provided that the consumer of the poetry in question has a rich store of sense memories that they can use to fully live into the words they're hearing through the poetry. So I suppose what I would say is that very, very core sensual, visceral things, like standing in front of a very large object, like the cathedral, or basking in the blazing kind of pink and golden setting sun, or standing at the top of a mountain and looking down into a valley, or gazing into a dark cave. Like, these are all visceral embodied human experiences that we use to understand words when we encounter the words, right? So the word dark, right? When we hear the word dark, our body, our memory summons for us all these past sense memories of our experience of darkness. Mm. If we hear the word height or the heavens, that summons for us all our past experiences of high things and heavenly things or things in the sky. If we have a rich enough personal memory storehouse of kind of more visceral experiential things like those, then I think that poetry can be extraordinarily powerful and maybe does rise to the heights that Hegel described. But if we are people who have spent most of our time in a small room playing video games with closed windows, never looking outside, never interacting with people, then that inner vocabulary, that even if we have words mapping to memories, our memories are impoverished. And any words that come to us are not going to be able to bear the full meaning that they might have borne otherwise. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah,
so you've got to build your experience based on the embodied and visceral, and then the words can kind of do their work after that.
Makes a lot of sense. On that note about the embodied and the visceral, you make another observation in your book, I think is really good and true. I'm quoting you here. You write, religion as such was never a list of privately held, rationally complementary beliefs, nor was it chiefly a private, soothing experience. Instead, religion has traditionally been about total self-relationship. Mm-hmm. All right. Can you elaborate what that means? I think the total self-relationship, you're talking about this kind of this embodied, not just embodied mm-hmm. in the sense of one's own body, but embodied in the sense of like a larger community body.
Yeah,
it's
yes.
part of what forms religion in the first place.
Right, and that's something you bring your total self into, and you're vulnerable to it, and you negotiate with it, and you're dependent on it. Yeah, exactly. I think that's right. Like, one thing I discuss a bit in the book is that our contemporary understanding of religion as a set of privately held beliefs doesn't seem to square up with how the ancients thought of religion.
Right.
Religion for the ancients was just a relationship with other beings that were actually there and that could affect you, and you could affect them. And so it was much more, I guess you could say, literal in a sense. But if you pledged yourself to a religious community, you were entering into a binding mutual relationship with real other beings, divine beings, who might ask things of you and to whom you owed things. And those other beings could be unpredictable. They might ask you to do surprising things. They were living and moving and had, you know, opinions and shifting wills according to circumstances. And so religion was much more about responding to the movement of the divine in the moment than it was about memorizing a bunch of precepts and then trying to live specifically according to them, as if, like, you learn the precepts and that's the point at which you're cut off from the divine. Like, the divine gives you these words, that's it, you're cut off, and you just follow those rules and you're done. No, I think when you have a much more, like, enchanted, sort of literal understanding of the gods really being there, then you realize you're in constant relationship with them, and they could constantly be asking you to do new and surprising things. And so that just, I think our modern idea of religion doesn't fully get that, and our modern view of religion is impoverished because of that.
That rings true to me. It mm-hmm. does. You can ignore this question if you want mm-hmm. to. You can say mm-hmm. move on. But do you see in your own religious life that you feel like you are in some kind of at least sense of God's presence, such that you may be asked to do things? Or that you mm-hmm. ask God in turn to do things.
Yeah, no, I think that's the goal. Like, I mean, for me, I would say my subjective experience of my faith is that I know God is out there. I know God's the best. I want to be someone who can fully receive what he has to tell me and what he has to ask of me. There are barriers in my life that prevent me from fully receiving that. And those barriers could be trauma. They could be deprivation, kind of things I described before. They could be situations that I'm in that might not be the best situations. You know, I think that, you know, we can make choices and put ourselves in situations where we block ourselves to, I suppose, divine communication, to intimacy with the divine, because it's like oil and water. Like, there are some things we can choose to do in our lives that the holy can't mix with, right? And so if we're in some of those situations, the divine's going to have a little bit of trouble making contact with us, I suppose. So I think for me, I think for my Christian life is one that is trying to find and remove barriers to communion with the divine. And the goal is constant, you know, accompaniment by the divine. That's the goal. And if something enters in that seems to be creating a barrier, it has to be identified and removed. And I think that's how I would characterize my spiritual life, actually, is, yeah, finding those barriers, removing them, and then trying to have kind of perfect openness to however God would want to guide me.
I love that. Mm-hmm. And that rings true to me. I know mm-hmm. Religion minus a sense of the divine or a sense of mm-hmm. God's presence is, I don't quite understand it.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I really don't. Uh-huh. In my case, I know that the kind of the imperfect openness that I feel I have is just my own, it could come from my behaviors. I mean, if I'm not acting as I should, right? Mm-hmm, that's a barrier. Mm-hmm. Or it could just be my own mortal limitation. I'm learning, evolving, growing, learning how to open myself more. But I feel like in my own spiritual life, I'm prompted or impressed to do things that are difficult that mm-hmm. I'd rather not do all the time. Mm-hmm. But also given enormous, I feel, best word for it is blessings as a function of the things that I receive, mm-hmm. right, from God. So what you say, I think, is very articulate, but also I think it really resonates. Mm-hmm, I think mm-hmm. for me, certainly, and for a lot of religious people, which I mm-hmm. really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. I want to throw one thing into that as well. I feel like idolatry is a big barrier. So I mean, I think if we want to receive intimacy or communication from the divine, we can't be like actively loving other things a lot more than we love God, because those are blocks as well. And so I think a big thing for me too in my spiritual life is to figure out like what might I be idolizing right now, and maybe I need to make efforts to completely sacrifice that so that that isn't a block to having like a more open prayer life. And I've definitely had to make that decision sometimes as well, just cut something off because I'm realizing I'm a little bit too obsessed with it. And then things can open back up again.
No, that's great. Yeah. Especially in a class, actually, this came up with some mm-hmm. students who were talking about, one of them mentioned about getting away from the idea of God as a grand vending machine.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Ask, like, mm-hmm. a transactional relationship.
Right.
I mean, uh-huh. if you wanted to put it in vending machine terms, mm-hmm. I mean, to really have a relationship with God means you need to be sort of willing to sort of put in your money and get nothing back.
Yeah, yeah,
and be
yeah.
okay with it.
Like, yeah,
in other words,
yeah.
In other words, mm-hmm. you have to be sort of be open to being surprised by yeah. what you may receive mm-hmm. and by being able to sort of get off the thing that you want mm-hmm. because you were redirected by some kind of relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And right. the other thing will be better in the long run. You just have yeah. to trust that it will be. Yeah.
That's right. Good. Okay. So in your book, you ask how we can learn from the reverence mm-hmm. That artworks intrinsically capture, and how we can draw on art to heal from the alienation and the trauma that characterize so much modern experience. And you suggest three things as most needful. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can expand on them for us.
Okay.
First, you said we should deepen our aesthetic literacy. Mm-hmm. Second, increase our historical understanding. Mm-hmm. And third, leverage theology.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'll probably, yeah. So I'll start with deepen aesthetic literacy. I want to go back with regard to that one, to that person sitting in their windowless, dark little room playing video games. And that person, as I mentioned before, doesn't build the sense memories necessary to be able to receive all the communications that like God's creation can give us. So they can hear words about greatness and sublimity and majesty, but they don't know what greatness and sublimity and majesty are because they haven't been exposed to it. Being in the dark little room with the windows shut playing a video game does not give you that exposure. It doesn't give you the right memories, the right sense memories. So for me, building aesthetic literacy, is that what it was, aesthetic literacy?
Yeah.
Is getting out. I mean, this is a really low bar. Like, it's just getting out and being open to the majesty that is in our environment in order to let it sort of, I don't know, infiltrate us with the right interior vocabulary so that we understand beauty and sublimity and majesty and these kind of pointers toward transcendence and stuff like that. So if we can like build up our inner vocabulary in that way, I think that's a great foundation to lay. And then on top of that, if we can move farther, which hopefully we can then look at how other human beings have used that vocabulary and have borne witness to it by like augmenting it and kind of glorifying it and ornamenting it. And so all the beauty that's in our environment, you know, the artists of the past, they have augmented that, and they've added to it through beautiful things like cathedrals and epic poetry and lovely paintings and murals and wonderful buildings and all these kinds of things. And if we have that inner vocabulary based on nature to start with, then I think we can see how the artificial things humans have made are augmenting that and resonating with it. And that builds our vocabulary further. And we then become people who are just able to receive so much more now from what is around us. And all those things point to God. And so we have so many more ways now if we have that vocabulary of understanding who God is.
Fantastic.
So that's the first one. Now, what was the second one?
The second one is increase historical understanding.
Oh, yeah. So I probably actually kind of addressed that.
Yeah,
in the first one.
So what does it mean to leverage theology then?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, and this is very interesting, I took people from my church and some other churches on a pilgrimage to Rome, Italy last summer.
Sounds great.
And I met there a man who leads pilgrimages in Jerusalem. And he told me that he doesn't think theology can be properly understood unless you have walked in the Holy Land and you understand the natural metaphors from which Christ's parables came. So then I stand accused. I've never been to the Holy Land, but I believe that. I agree with him. Like, I think I have probably a somewhat impoverished view of the true, like, original theology of Jesus, as he would have wanted me to, like, immediately understand it, because I have not physically experienced those metaphors in that environment. And so I believe a lot of theological debate, a lot of the really harsh and acrimonious divisions that have occurred, you know, in the body of Christians over history, I think some of that could be rectified or smoothed out or could go away if we could all kind of come together and learn and share some of those same originating metaphors. Yeah, so I think there's this work to be done in terms of integrating verbal theology with the material culture that produced the seed of that theology in the first place.
Okay.
And once we can do that, I think we can see beautiful movements toward mutual understanding and unity.
Okay, good. And by the way, I told you I went to Rome a few years ago for the first time. 3 years later, I went to Israel for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I've actually been there.
Mm-hmm.
Rome and Jerusalem are both these archaeologically layered cities, like layer upon layer. You know, built and rebuilt and rebuilt and rebuilt. And so it's hard to get to the original thing itself,
right? Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Dust, ding, it's hard to get to. But it's fantastic. And you see kind of the, I mean, it's gorgeous, it's historical. And then to get out and about and just the countryside, some of the iconic scenes, you know, are amazing, right, to behold. Like that mountain, that valley, that plain, you know, that body of water, et cetera.
Yeah.
Incredible.
No, I hope to go someday soon.
So one of the things I found moving about your book, kind of compelling, provocative about it, was its reflections on goodness. Early in the book, you write that goodness could be described as the capacity to be magnetized to the right thing, the capacity to love rightly and to act in honor of that love. And then later in the book, you write about the relationship between goodness, truth, and beauty, with goodness being the chief of all of these as a condition, I'm quoting you again, a condition in which things are healthfully and joyfully as they should be. And then with truth being defined as a proper recognition of goodness and beauty as the symbol of the good, its lure and promise. I've got a couple questions about that.
Yeah.
What do you say to someone who would contend that it's difficult to describe goodness in terms of an allure to the, quote, right thing, right? Either because goodness is relative, what's good for one person might be good for someone else, or that goodness is so dispersed and appears in so many diverse forms that it makes no practical sense to think of it in terms of the right thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is tough.
It's a modern sentiment here.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely. I think that passage that you're referring to in the book came downstream of a conversation I had with a Dominican monk about the work of Thomas Aquinas.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was eye-opening to me because that is actually how Thomas Aquinas describes goodness, truth, and beauty. And so I adopted it for myself. I felt like it was very compelling, and it gave me a way to think about those things in ways that weren't locked to like specific propositional rules. Like this one specific thing is always the right thing to do in this scenario, and you have to check off the box, which feels very rigid. So it helped get away from like very linear legalistic rigidity, but also provided a grounding for truth, goodness, and beauty that didn't kind of give in to like total postmodern relativism. At the same time, it is, you know, it's hard to like find easy prescriptions forward if you embrace this model of like how truth, goodness, and beauty work, because in a way it might be a little bit different for every person. And yet, well, because every person is different and every person has different intrinsic qualities and every situation is different. And so in a way that can be a bit maddening, but we have to trust that God has a plan. And Thomas Aquinas, based on the work of Aristotle, uses this word telos, teleological endpoint, this endpoint that we're working toward that is our destiny. And there's this like destiny horizon that everything is pointing toward. And the good for you is your own proper outworking toward that destiny. And that's going to be a little bit different for everyone. But goodness per se is just the proper healthy outworking toward that destiny. And so, yeah, I don't know if that answered your question. And that is a bit maddening for people who want specific rules to follow. But for me, it's very compelling and like very hopeful and very beautiful.
I was drawn to it too. I like that. And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, right? Mm-hmm. About feeling compelled by goodness to try to discern for yourself in a situation what that right thing is and to try to respond to it.
Yeah.
Something I actually really appreciate and really admire about your work is that you were trained at Harvard, right? And you're very conversant in modern and contemporary art. But there's also this deep historical sensibility that you have too. Mm-hmm. So you really are always kind of toggling between two different almost domains of art, which I think is really great. There are a couple modern tendencies of which you're critical, though. I think rightly so. Mm-hmm. And by modern, I'll explain to listeners, I don't mean modern in the last 10 years. I mean modern is like modernity, right? So the last couple hundred years, things that have kind of formed themselves over time. And one of these traits which you're critical is the trait aestheticism, and another is the term eclecticism.
Yes.
Right? Now, can you explain to our listeners what these terms mean?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Both of these, they're aesthetic trends that emerged from this big early modern moment of like colonialism and industrialism, where all of a sudden you have all these different cultural manifestations thrown together. Like now say modern explorers coming from Europe, now they're seeing all these things they've never seen before. Their cultural horizons have expanded dramatically in a very short period of time, and they don't know what to do with all this new data. They don't have they don't have the time and space to figure out what it came from and what it actually means. And so what we get is a fairly long period of time where artists and culture makers in Western Europe and America end up doing the caricature version of things. Like they're being exposed to these new cultural manifestations. And so they skim the top off of it. They take what they can kind of get and recognize immediately and start appropriating it and kind of appreciating it and using it, and then just keep running from there, and they never actually understand it. So aestheticism is this idea that there are beautiful things across the world, beautiful things across cultures. It's good to appreciate those beautiful things, and it's completely acceptable to appropriate them, take them into your home, talk about them, kind of play with them, remix them, collage them, whatever, just out of pure appreciation for their beauty, by which I mean optical beauty. That is like maybe their sense of balance and proportion and, you know, tasteful color palette and stuff like that. And in fact, this is an enlightened way of engaging with world culture in this early period of like colonialism and industry, because it allows every culture to be appreciated. It's kind of giving props to everyone. Every culture has produced things that are well-balanced and beautiful. And so, yeah, we're just going to give them props for that. And we're going to consume this stuff and appreciate it and hang it in our homes, appreciating its visible beauty without trying to learn that much more about it. We don't really care about the original context. We just appreciate it because it's beautiful. And what this effectively does actually is it ends up elevating optical beauty to like the fundamental value, because that is the one value that seems able to unite everything. And that's the one value that kind of can put everything on a similar playing field in this new era of like contention between cultures and things. And so this superficial focus on purely optical beauty becomes way overblown in its importance. And it's very instrumental in just ensuring that a whole bunch of cultural manifestations are completely misunderstood and never rooted in their proper context. And in fact, beauty then also in that context is kind of held up as a distinctively modern value that anyone can appreciate and that unites an enlightened world that can appreciate things for their beauty and doesn't really care about their maybe superstitious origins or something like that. Hopefully that made sense.
It does make sense. Yeah, no, it does. Yeah. Just my own way of kind of thinking about it, what you're talking about is the problem. On the one hand, good for, you know, our modern world, our modern selves, being able to appreciate things that are so diverse and different from our own experience. On the other hand, though, when you kind of like flatten that all out into just purely surface appearance and loveliness, you decontextualize it, you dehistoricize it, you render it a function of kind of consumer interest.
It's very consumerist.
Hey, I like that. What do you like? And there's no sense here for the depth out of which these things are produced culturally, right?
Yeah, it's very consumerist. Absolutely right. I think like 20th century consumer culture, I think, is directly derived from this aestheticist movement in the late 19th century that had rather enlightened ambitions to like put everything culturally globally on the same playing field, celebrate the beauty of all of it, reduce everything to this like thin layer of just superficial beautiful appearances as kind of a diplomatic gesture. And then that, you know, slippery slope kind of leads to the consumerism we have today. And then eclecticism is similar to aestheticism in that it also kind of slices and dices and extracts kind of superficial, easy to digest elements from cultural manifestations. But instead of being like just the optically beautiful ones, it tends to extract the kind of dramatic, spectacular, movie explosion type ones. I don't know. It's dramatic and spectacular. It's something feels really like scary or really dramatic or really impressive in a way that's not necessarily beautiful, but it has these very captivating, like dramatic emotional associations. And so eclecticism extracts in a different way. It might extract things because they feel very romantic or very scary or very dramatic instead of very beautiful, but very, very similar in motivation.
Yeah. So one of your arguments in the book is that institutional religion needs to sort of move in concert with our deep religious drives, and not obstruct those drives, not reduce them to this thin layer of just consumer, right? But to really kind of come to understand and draw on these religious drives and channel them through the art that we engage or produce. And you have some suggestions. I'll ask about a couple of them here. Suggestions for how we keep with your book's theme of healing through beauty. One, you say, offer authentic beauty, not cheap shortcuts. So what's an example of like a cheap shortcut that you're saying, oh, I don't like that so much?
That's a good question. I think like a specific example, I'm going to say that an artist who thematized the whole idea of cheap shortcut is Andy Warhol. And he just dials this up to 11. I don't know if anyone gets a Spinal Tap movie reference. Have you seen that movie?
Yes, I have, yeah.
But like, if we think about his screen prints of Marilyn Monroe, and I don't know if your listeners will, you can Google this, but he takes a Hollywood actress known for her physical beauty, and sometimes was a pretty good actress too, but who has this full physical presence, and then reduces her to flat planes of garish color, as if to suggest that for the mid-20th century American consumer, the flat planes of garish color that just sketch out the vibe of Marilyn Monroe without actually capturing her full personhood are sufficient. That we have been kind of programmed and sensitized in such a way that we're looking for the quick shortcut to the like kind of Marilyn Monroe bright sexy dopamine hit without really caring about the person underneath or even being able anymore to understand kind of the full package of that person, of that specific actress who is a real human being. So I think for me, a lot of the work of Andy Warhol is a visual diagram of how like this type of aesthetic flattening functions. And pop art in general, I feel like, is kind of trying to point that out. I think kitsch culture is that. I mean, I think you can still do this like truck stops throughout the American West and in other places as well. You can go to the like little gift section and see little statues of like dragons and like fairies. I don't know. Do you guys see that at truck stops? Yeah. But it's stuff that's been it's poorly crafted, but it's like superficially very enchanting and beautiful. And it's the kind of thing that a tired person on a road trip is just maybe kind of drawn toward. But if you investigate it, if you like look at the details and slight asymmetries and how poorly crafted it is, it can start to disgust you after a moment. And then you hate it. At least that's kind of how I feel about it. But I think there's like a whole kitsch industry that does this as well. A lot of children's toys, you know, are kind of like this. But also just a lot of kitsch art too. Honestly, I've taken a cruise one time and they have like big art auctions on cruise ships, and it's all very kitsch and very like art that signals like bright, happy, beautiful. But if you look at it a little bit harder, it's very unsatisfying. But there are all these industries of this kind of thing, and it's very easy to commodify, but it doesn't satisfy.
Yeah, you mentioned kitsch. Kitsch is interesting because it kind of cuts two ways.
I
think even in churches, you know, instructional videos, mm-hmm. you know, in churches for youth can have kind of a kitschy quality.
That's
the
true.
Stories are kind of like canned and they're short, they're very dramatic, and the music is very dramatic. And it's not meant to sort of really force you to sort of go deep to understand what's being communicated or conveyed.
That's true, yeah.
Right, it's on the surface.
It's meant to be very easily digestible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in that respect, that's kitschy, and it kind of bypasses the struggle of a lot of, you know, kind of religious enlightenment, you know, or spiritual contact with the divine.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, kitsch, precisely because it is so rooted in use, you know, is also kind of democratic in a way.
Yeah.
And it's trying to sort of communicate something in broadly that can be understood by many, and it's not elitist. Mm-hmm. So it kind of cuts both ways.
Yeah,
in a way,
I see. You have a little soft spot for kitsch. You have
The soft spot partly was Walter Benjamin.
Oh, okay.
Who had a soft spot for kitsch in a way, in the sense that he talked about how use values differ from exchange values.
Yeah,
some of the high art, which is impossible to get to, but in certain places, and to understand fully until you're deeply educated. And that has its virtue and its place.
Yes.
I'm an educator, and I love that stuff.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But there's a place also for kitsch in the sense that it is really about allowing many people to experience some measure of an experience.
Thing. I would agree with that.
Right?
I agree. I think.
But what you're talking about is right. I mean, the Andy Warhol this, or the figurines in the truck stops, or the truck stopification of religious experience, all that kind of thing. Yeah, I'm with you on all that.
Yes, I do think, kitsch has its place. I mean, I mentioned children's toys as well, and I think it's absolutely appropriate for children's toys to be kitsch in that way, because that's kind of the level of communication that children need.
Yeah.
And I think even kitsch can function to be comforting to people in their older age, is something that reminds them of their childhood, and something that is more easily digestible and that's been with them for years. And I think maybe only when kitsch is, when people try somewhat dishonestly to elevate kitsch to high art, that's when it really grates, probably.
Yeah, good.
And
that
has been done so much just to make money. So
absolutely right. Yeah, good. Okay. Now, just a couple last questions. So you have chapters in the book on painting and sculpture and architecture and dress, all of which express religious themes in some way. Was there one of those chapters that you enjoyed writing the most? It was hardest to write the most, or what you learned the most?
Gosh.
Is there one of those? Mm-hmm. Because they're all, I learned from all of them. But for you, the writer, was there one of those that you thought, that one right there meant something a bit different from the others for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm almost forgetting the chapter titles. Right now I'm very interested in space. And so I really enjoyed writing about high places. Like that's a theme in the book, is that different cultures in the world have created high places for themselves that they can look up to, such as the Gothic Cathedral, and that they can also climb up to or climb onto in order to give a sense of ascent. And then pilgrimage, I just went on a pilgrimage last year with people from my church and was very, very attuned to that experience of walking, experiencing space as we walked, experiencing the effort that it took to reach our destination, and then like noticing way markers along the way that kind of encouraged us toward our destination, and even feeling the heat of the environment and the rough cobblestones, and how the aestheticization of pilgrimage is so deeply entrenched in places like Italy that it just becomes this total, just immersive experience that fires on all cylinders and can be very transformative. So that's stuff that I enjoyed writing because I had recent and powerful experience of it. The chapter about transformation through dress, though, I feel like for me that's something I want to continue thinking about more, especially in dialogue with my students, because I know my students are very conscious of how they look every day. They make very deliberate decisions about how they dress, but sometimes they're not really sure why they're making those decisions. Mm. And for me, that's a growth area for me to think about, and for my students to think about as well, is like, how are we configuring ourselves when we move out into the world every day? What are we saying about our bodies? What are we saying about, like, if we believe that we're made in the image of God, how are we reflecting that in how we dress? How are we doing that unconsciously? How are we doing that consciously? I think there's a lot more to kind of be learned about that. And I feel like just pedagogically, that's a rich area for me. I'm just in terms of interacting with my students. So that's probably something that I'm looking forward to thinking about more.
Okay, good. A couple last questions here. So one of the things I appreciate about your work is that there is a kind of a personal rigor implicit in it, in trying to understand, you know, things that are complicated, in being drawn and driven toward to do what's good, to try to find the good and to discern it and to live toward it. But there's also a generosity in the book, in the sense that you write toward the conclusion of the book, that I'm quoting you here, there's a glimmer of goodness and beauty in everything. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though you're mm-hmm. wholesale condemning large swathes of human existence mm-hmm. and embracing only a few small things. And I guess with that in mind, that there's a glimmer of goodness in everything, mm-hmm. Do you find yourself occasionally surprised by beauty kind of jumping mm-hmm. out of places that you wouldn't have thought to have seen mm-hmm. it, where you mm-hmm. suddenly you find a trace or glimmer of things divine, and things that otherwise appear thoroughly mundane? Mm-hmm. Does that happen for you?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, this is maybe not new for me, but I love folk art. When my family travels, and Matt, as you know, I was telling Matt, my family drives cross country a lot because we live in Seattle and we drive to visit family in Indiana, and sometimes we enjoy taking road trips from Indiana to the east as well. I've lived in many different parts of the U.S. Over the course of my life, but I always love to seek out like local folk art traditions. And when I see local kind of folk art manifestations, the different places I go, I'm always drawn to them because I feel like, and that, I don't know, that's often such a very like innocent, immediate expression of how sometimes rather isolated individuals are trying to express their appreciation for the universe and the creative drive that is inside of them. And I think that you can often find such beautiful things in all kinds of folk art that are very unexpected because they're coming from, again, oftentimes situations of isolation where maybe someone has lived in the same rural community their whole lives, and their personal cultural vocabulary is not that great, but they have a really deep understanding of the specific kind of natural environment that's around them. And they can use that very particular experience to communicate things with a kind of depth that nobody else can communicate because nobody else has had that kind of rather isolated yet deep experience. And so I think there are just enormous beauties to be found in that realm. Yeah, I love to look at folk art. You know, my daughter's children cartoons that she watches sometimes, I think they're often unexpected kind of brilliant little things in there as well. Like just some creative animator throws something in there and it's like, wow, that was actually really profound or really beautiful. So yeah, I do think like all over the place you see that pop up for sure.
Yeah, fantastic. Let me close with this question here. Your book's dedication, I really like this. You wrote, "For those who sacrifice everything to embody Jesus."
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely thought.
Mm-hmm.
Why that dedication? What does that look like to you?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I think my first dedication, so I have been privileged over the last few years to get to know some Catholic priests very well, who are very faithful priests who have, and of course, if you're a Catholic priest, you give up having a family, you give up having possessions. It's what the ancient monastic orders talk about, the three evangelical councils: poverty, chastity, and obedience. And so you choose not to have a home or possessions or any of the traditional trappings of life in order to give yourself completely to the service of the church. And I know, you know, there are all kinds of movies about like corrupt Catholic priests and I don't know, and certain abuses that happen and so on and so forth. But I've met some individuals over the last few years who really live out that ideal, where they have like taken their whole selves and resolved to possess nothing and just want to throw themselves completely into the service of others. And I've found that to be very eye-opening and paradigm shifting for me to see someone with that level of personal sacrifice and commitment. But yeah, that inscription, you know, I originally had thought about naming a specific couple of people in that inscription, but then decided to make it more general, because I think kind of seeing those examples and open my eyes to how other kinds of people who, you know, maybe aren't following those three evangelical councils that I just described are also just giving of themselves completely. And you can see that they are. And you can see that they have reached a point of complete surrender in their lives where everything they do is meant as a service for others. And they hold on to everything very loosely. And what the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. And you allow yourself to be a vessel of something greater than you. And you allow the resources you have to kind of pass to you and then pass away from you as the Lord decrees. And so it's just this openness to providence. And I just think that's very beautiful. And I think that the aesthetic strategies I describe in the book, like are meant to cultivate that kind of openness to God's creation, are meant to kind of heal the soul in such a way that all of us hopefully can become people who are just open-handed, not holding on to anything too tightly and just being perpetually open to providence. So I think that inscription is also just a goal for myself and for everyone.
It's a great goal.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
think it's lovely. It really is.
Yeah.
It's great. Thank you for writing this book.
Yeah.
And for coming on the podcast and coming to BYU.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's great to see you here.
Yeah,
Katie.
Thank you. It's lovely
so
to be here. Everyone has been so kind. And it's such a beautiful day today, like almost 80 degrees. So
I know.
Yeah.
In March, it worries
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yep. Okay, mm-hmm. So. Yes.
All right. Thanks, Katie.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Kate Thorpe. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.